It's the confluence where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Coming up, recommendations for more transparency in discipline for judicial misconduct. And 18 students at Penn State face charges in connection with the death of a fraternity pledge. But first, a month ago, Pennsylvania Lieutenant Governor Mike Stack acknowledged he was under investigation by the Office of the Inspector General for staffing issues, as he called them. Those issues were allegations of repeated verbal abuse of staff at his state-supplied residence, as well as his state police detail. The investigation continues. Now we're learning about his expenditures of state taxpayer dollars. Joining us now by phone from Harrisburg, veteran Capitol reporter Brad Bumstead, bureau chief for The Caucus, the weekly newspaper covering politics and state government. Brad, welcome.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate you having me on.
And in studio, your colleague, Mike Warshak, an investigative reporter for The Caucus. Mike, good to see you again.
Good to see you as well.
If you have a question or comment, tweet us using the hashtag WESAConfluence. Okay, you filed a right-to-know request to get information on these expenditures. When did you start probing, asking questions about the lieutenant governor's expenditures? Brad, let's start with you.
Well, initially, right after the we became aware through sources, and I was able to confirm that there was an investigation by the Inspector General's Office of Stacks, their Stacks alleged abuse of staff, it became an issue. Well, you know, what all do they spend and what do they get? For instance, the first thing we were able to find out, this was last month, was that it cost $450,000 a year to maintain the only lieutenant governor's mansion that's provided to a lieutenant governor in the nation. Then, you know, I filed a right-to-know-all request and got information on his travel expenses, which were about $18,000, and showed that he had billed the state for Philadelphia hotel rooms while he still had a home in Philadelphia. He had to return some of that money. But then I kept, when I looked at some other documents, it became clear that there wasn't any money for meals or food for the mansion. And so I started asking around, where is that? Well, it's on their so-called P card, their purchase card, which is like a credit card. Mm-hmm. So I filed for that. And indeed, get this material back that Mike was able to work with in a database and put together that shows $73,400 of spending by the lieutenant governor's office, which his aides say, you know, was for wide usage, you know, by the office of staff, of visiting dignitaries, for various people who visited the mansion or the office, but, you know, not for Stack himself for the most part. But clearly the $34,000 in groceries, counting delivery, was primarily for the Stacks.
Okay. I want to follow up on some of these different categories of expenditures. And, Mike, let me start with you. The grocery, so Brad mentioned more than $450,000 to maintain this state-provided residence. And that didn't include groceries for them to eat day to day, or it did, or these were additional expenses for groceries, or what?
Well, the $452,000 is maintaining what's called the State House. It's this old stone house, a stone mansion, really, in Fort Indian Town Gap, which is a National Guard base. It's got a 5-car garage. It has a pool. It's a big place, and the state pays to maintain it, to keep it running, and to keep it livable for the current inhabitants, which at the moment are the Stacks, Michael and Tanya. But the groceries, these other expenses, are coming through credit card purchases. They're not coming through the same fund. So they spent, for instance, $29,000 at one giant grocery store in Hummelstown. We have Giant Eagle out here. They have Giant out there.
Right.
So he's got... there's also $3,800 in delivered groceries, which is a separate expenditure. On top of that, $15,000 in Amazon.com expenses, including $4,200 in candy and snacks. And this is not part of that $452,000.
So, Brad, when you filed the right to know, did you have to do it like step by step by step, or was it a blanket kind of thing for these expenditures, or what?
What do you mean?
In terms of, in terms of right to know all of the lieutenant governor's expenditures.
Yeah. The latter. That's what I did. But the point is, and it stems from Mike's answer to your previous question, I had to file three different places for this information.
Okay.
First with the Department of General Services for the money to, you know, operate the mansion. I had to get that from General Services, not a right to know law. But then that didn't include these other expenses, so I had to file that with the Office of Budget and the Lieutenant Governor's Office. I got it from the Office of Budget.
Okay.
The same day that I got that request back, the Lieutenant Governor's Office took a 30-day extension.
The Lieutenant Governor, in addition to the state provided residence, which Brad said earlier, and I want to repeat, that we're the only state that does this for its Lieutenant Governor, Mike?
The only state.
Did you know that going into
this? I had no idea. Brad was the one who actually who dug that part up. And I, you know, first I wasn't entirely aware that the Lieutenant Governor had a state-provided residence. And then the more you learn about it, the more you realize it's a pretty nice place.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like a legislator's per diem, Brad.
No, it's not. It's a pretty luxurious residence, and there are critics of this who say, some who say we don't even need a lieutenant governor and that should be changed. But if we're going to have one, at least right now, the lieutenant governor should stay in the governor's mansion here in Harrisburg. Because why? Well, because the Wolfs don't live there. He's entitled to live there, Governor Tom Wolf and his wife Frances, but they don't. They stay at their home in Mount Wolf in York County, about 20 miles down the road. So there's an empty house there that's only used for occasional entertaining by the Wolfs.
Okay, so let's get into some of the expenditures that you say, well, these really stand out, or these are for odd things that one might think of. Can you itemize a few of them? We'll start with Mike, and then Brad, please chime in.
Sure. Almost $3,300 in coffee kind of stuck out to me. And as a person who really enjoys coffee, you know, that's an awful lot.
So this is on top of the groceries.
Oh, this is totally separate. This is not part of that $34,000 in groceries. We were able to tease out these purchases because they were made through Amazon, and we could look up the product, go through individual product codes and run them through the Amazon website and find out what this stuff is for. So $3,300 in coffee. Of the 40-some hundred dollars in snacks and candy, there was about $1,200 in Clif bars. Clif bars are these energy bars that are used by runners.
See at the checkouts, a lot of the grocery stores. Yeah.
Right. So that seemed like an awful lot of Clif bars, too. Stack is a big fitness buff, but his office told Brad that, you know, these were not for him. These were for staff.
Okay. Brad, if you'd like
to... staff and other visitors to the office, but primarily staff who have to work late hours, and so they have something to eat there. That's what they claim these are for the Lieutenant Governor's office, not the mansion.
I think there was about $450 for flags, including a Swiss flag and a Flemish flag. There was another, over $100 in packets of squeezable applesauce, which kind of jumped out at me. Possibly something that a runner might use, you know, as they're running along, they can just pop it in their mouth, or for young kids. We have no idea what it was used for. Again, the governor's office said Stack did not have any of that.
So I want to go back to the Clif bars, because you thought it was a high number. But, you know, Clif bars, aren't they sort of high in calories? A lot of people use those as meal substitutes. So is there any sense that – I know you couldn't get into how they were being used, but
– Well, that's the thing. These records only take us so far.
Right.
So they let us know what was purchased, but not what happened after it was purchased.
Or who ate them, right.
Right. So we have to rely on the Lieutenant Governor's office to provide those answers. And their answer is no, this was not something that Mike Stack did. He didn't eat this. This was for other people.
So, Brad, Mike brings up something that I'd like to follow up with you is you got the information, but I'm sure as reporters, you've got a lot more questions about this information. What's still on your mind about these expenditures?
Well, this is a typical thing where you have documents that show you the basics. Okay, here's what was spent, and here are these categories. But you don't really know what happened to them other than the source, and no disrespect intended to Lieutenant Governor Stack or his staff, but which has a vested interest in presenting this a certain way. So, you know, unless you could spend a whole lot more time talking to staff and former staffers, and there are plenty of those, you know, to find out how some of this material was used and who ate it, you know, it would take quite a while to put that together. So, yeah, I have ongoing questions about what happened to all this and who used it and why they made certain purchases.
And another, just something to add to that, the expenditures include $1,700 spent on this card at beer distributors. But the office, you know, Stack's office, the Lieutenant Governor's office has told us that this is, they did not buy alcohol with this. This was not for beer. They bought soda. They bought, yeah, bottled water.
Never have, never will, is I believe how they put it.
Right.
We're talking with Mike Wershagen, investigative reporter for the Caucus, the weekly newspaper that covers state government and politics, and the bureau chief for the Caucus. Brad Bumstead joins us by phone. We're talking about expenditures by the lieutenant governor. So, and by the way, this is a preview of your big cover story that's coming out in the next issue next week. Is that correct, Brad?
That is. We kept this fairly general, believe it or not, even though, you know, we're going over some of these what seem like specifics. We kept it fairly general because we initially intended to do this for next Tuesday. We just didn't think the story could wait, so we got it out, and that just sort of helps tease the interest in Tuesday's edition, which will be all about, Stack spending. And, glad we're able to do that, and hopefully, people who are interested can go to caucuspa.com and hook up with a subscription.
Okay, so let us talk about what did any Stack staffers, chief of staff or whatever, tell you as you asked for comment or more information, Mike?
Yeah, they said that this is...
Go ahead, Brad.
I'm sorry, go ahead. One thing they said was that you have to understand with items that did go to the governor's mansion that they had 30 different events out there since the lieutenant governor took office, since he was sworn in January of 2015. And that, you know, some of the food and drink was for that. I said, well, what were the 30 events? Send me a list of it. I still don't have it.
Okay. Mike.
So I don't doubt that there were 30 events, but who were they?
Then they also say that this is not out of the ordinary. This is something that lieutenant governors do as part of their job duties. They host events. They, you know, they bring in dignitaries. They, you know, they wine and dine people who are visiting the state. And this is, you know, the cost of doing business in a sense. And that he's not any different than anybody else.
Well, since you said not different than anybody else, and I will say, what about other lieutenant governors in the past? So are these kind of expenditures unusual, do we know? Or do we get, have you found records about past expenses from other lieutenant governors?
Well, you could compare this to, I mean, you don't have to leave the state. You don't even have to leave the executive branch of Pennsylvania. You look at Governor Tom Wolf, who pays for his own stationery, who drives his, you know, who doesn't use the state, the governor's mansion, who, you know, doesn't charge for travel or
mileage. He could, but he is a millionaire.
He is. That's exactly it. And that was sort of his, that was part of his campaign, was that, look, I'm not going to do this sort of thing. So, you know, the law says you can do this. It's up to the individual elected official whether they choose to.
So are there any questions?
In answer to your question, we don't really know. We don't have the records readily available from previous lieutenant governors, but I would just say from my own experience here at the Capitol that Stack's staff is probably correct that other lieutenant governors do the same types of things. Whether they do it to the same extent or spend as much, we don't know.
Okay. So as I mentioned earlier in the program, this information from the caucus, from you two gentlemen, comes to light after it was revealed that Governor Wolf ordered an investigation into allegations of repeated verbal abuse by Stack of staff at the state-supplied residence, as well as his security detail. I spoke with the governor last week about that investigation. He was, you might say, a bit evasive. He kept saying he wanted to be fair to state workers who were involved and also to the lieutenant governor. Let's take a little bit of a listen.
Really just like to let that process unfold and keep this from becoming bigger than it deserves to be.
You stripped the lieutenant governor of his state police detail and reduced the size of state worker staff. Isn't it a fairly big issue if you're going to take those actions?
As I say, I'm trying to protect the employees, and I'm trying to be fair to everybody involved. So I think I'm going to leave it at that.
Once the process has unfolded, will you release the findings of the investigation to the public?
I haven't seen the final product, so I think we all need to let this process unfold.
Whatever the final results are of the investigation, do you want Mike Stack as a running mate next year?
As you know, in Pennsylvania, the lieutenant governor runs in the primary separate and apart from the candidate or candidates for governor, and so that's going to be up to the voters of Pennsylvania.
But how would you feel if the people of Pennsylvania select the lieutenant governor for renomination?
I'll abide by the decision of the people of Pennsylvania.
All right, Governor Tom Wolf there. So, Brad, I want to start with you. We just have 2 minutes remaining.
Yeah.
And from that investigation, from this investigation into the lieutenant governor's expenses that the caucus has done, and anything else that you've been hearing about in Harrisburg, would it be unexpected to have those two on the same ticket?
Well, I mean, as the governor stated, he's correct. He can't do anything to prevent the lieutenant governor from running, and they could wind up on the same ticket. However, the governor has an enormous amount of influence, an enormous amount of money, and he could, privately back another candidate or try to get someone else into the race, or he could come out and endorse someone else. You know, we just don't know at this point, and I think that the governor said wants to prevent us from becoming a big deal. And you said, well, isn't it already a big deal when you take away the state police? It is a big deal. And it's a big deal because of the politics of it. And as Mike has pointed out, as we've discussed this, it's about, who's going to be the next governor or lieutenant governor, not this administrative investigation.
Mike, you get the final word.
Yeah, this state just voted for a Republican president for the first time since the late 80s. Tom Wolf is a Democrat running for re-election in that environment. And he's got what, appears to be, if not a political liability, some pretty serious political questions here that are going to have to be answered.
Mike Wershagen is investigative reporter for the caucus. Brad Bumstead is the bureau chief for the caucus. Gentlemen, we look forward to your full front cover story next week in the caucus, and thanks so much.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Coming up, voters will be selecting nominees for judgeships Tuesday. Meantime, a new report urging changes to discipline for judicial misconduct. That's next on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Tuesday, voters will select nominees for judges at the state, county, municipal levels. You might be surprised by the required qualifications for some of the current and would-be judges. But first, we're going to discuss discipline for judicial misconduct. Join us in studio is Charlie Deitch, editor of Pittsburgh City Paper. Welcome, Charlie.
Thanks for having me back.
And we're also joined by David Harris, professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law and host of the podcast Criminal Injustice. Welcome, David.
Good to be with you.
If you have a question or comment, you can tweet us using the hashtag WESAConfluence. All right. A few weeks ago, the nonpartisan Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts issued a report dealing with judicial discipline system as a result of some high-profile cases in recent years. We're going to talk about the recommendations in a few minutes. But first, an incident or two that could lead to the disciplining of a senior judge of the Court of Common Pleas in Allegheny County, Judge Lester Nahas. He came under fire recently for some comments he made. Charlie, let's start with you. You've been reporting on this. Let's kick things off with you.
Yeah, in March, we actually ran a story, came incidentally through another. We were working on something else entirely, and we heard about a harassment case in front of Lester Nahas. So we went to that hearing, and he had some very odd things to say to the victim. We reported on that. And then from that, we got a call about 10 days ago from the mother of a 15-year-old girl, 16 now, 15 years old at the time of the incident. She had been, it was sort of unequivocal. She was touched in a sexually inappropriate manner in her high school by a classmate. He was convicted, and in summary cases, the defendants get a chance to appeal their sentence. And in this
appeal
case,
the sentence, appeal, not the conviction.
Correct. And okay. So in this particular point, although that has happened in the previous case, Nahas did dismiss the harassment charge.
Okay.
But he's a just turned 18-year-old. He's a student. He's in the foster system. So they argued for the fine to be reduced. Through this, however, Judge Nahas decided, he out of the blue asked the victim how many times she was touched by the defendant. She said 6 or 7 times, and he said, fine, a $6 fine. And the assistant district attorney, Jeff Tissack, responded back, Judge, this is highly inappropriate for you to suggest to a victim of a crime like this that the penalty, a penalty of $1 per touch, is appropriate in this case. And so it went on from there. The DA's office is, I believe, still considering whether to file a complaint.
Okay.
With the judicial board.
Let me bring in David here. What is the process? Is it up to the DA's office to file a complaint against the judge? Can a citizen, can the mother file a complaint? How does that work, David?
Anybody can file a complaint, as far as I know, Kevin. But the process is cumbersome. It is not easy to do. It can't be done online, for instance, like we would expect in today's world. You have to file a piece of paper and send it by mail. And then there is a fair amount of opaqueness in the process. It's several stages. Pieces of it are disclosed, but other pieces are not. And then there's no public airing of any of this until it reaches a very late stage, if it does reach a late stage. And so in a state like ours that has had 3 justices of its Supreme Court removed in the last few years, one for a criminal conviction and 2 in the Porngate thing, I think all citizens should really be concerned that we don't have a process that's easy to understand and transparent and will take care of complaints in a way that citizens can understand and be confident in.
I want to get to that late stage, but I want to get something else you said earlier on. So got to file it the old-fashioned way, paper, et cetera, instead of electronically. But is it understandable to even know how to do this, how to begin the process, or is that even difficult?
Oh, it's difficult. I mean, I had to look it up myself. I mean, I'm a licensed attorney. I'm a law professor. It varies enough from any kind of a transparent and open process that I wouldn't guess at it before coming in here and talking to you about it. So this is not an easy process to follow. Like I said, it isn't easy to understand. It isn't transparent. So I think it's high time to take a look at it.
Charlie, I want to get you on. You mentioned the DA's office is considering.
Right.
Okay. Do we have any idea of the timeline of when they'll end their consideration and either do it or not do it?
Yeah, well, at this time we don't. We reached out on Monday, I believe, to see if there was an update before we went to press, and there hadn't been an update at that time. I do know that the victim and her family are going to file a complaint. We've been in contact with the victim's mother since the day this happened. They contacted us because, again, as David said, they had no idea. I mean, they knew they were wrong. They felt wrong, but they had no idea where to go to try and get some sort of justice in their mind. I mean, they had no clue, and it's just it's not easy for someone in that state to think or in that stage to think, how do I take on a judge? I mean, somebody who I'm supposed to trust will give me justice.
David, so we get to that end point, or you said even if you get to that end point, what's the difficulty? Is just and is part of the problem transparency or a lie? You use the term opaque.
Yes, part of the problem is transparency. The way the process is set up, it goes through two levels of hearings through in front of different bodies. And it is only in the final stage, Charlie may remember what the name for the body is, where it could actually be public. And then the Supreme Court could actually take on the matter, too, if it is appealed to the Supreme Court. But before that, everything is kind of behind closed doors. Now, there are reasons for having a complaint be at least initially screened in a way that is not out in the public, because anybody could make a complaint and a complaint may not be justified. I mean, lots of public bodies operate like that. But once you get a complaint that is investigated and proceedings are going on, this is not somebody who has a private sector job. A judge is a public office holder.
And that's part of the issue in Judge Nahas's case in particular. He's technically retired. I mean, he's a senior judge. So this would have been his year. 2017, he would be up for his retention vote, his 10-year retention vote. But he retired, and then he was appointed to senior status, and he's being used in Allegheny County courts, you know, on a regular basis. Yet there's no way for the public, except for this very opaque process, there's no way for the public to have their say on whether or not he's doing a good job or should, you know, hit the streets.
So are senior judges, do they face retention, or is it just, no, they're retired officially,
right?
And as the caseloads mount up, the president judge or administrative judge sends cases to these senior judges, David?
That's right. I mean, the Supreme Court certifies them as eligible to participate. And in general, we like that because it helps with caseload. They can be put in places. They're utility infielders, you know, that sort of thing where we need them. But they are no longer subject to those public retention votes as a kind of check on them, on their as a way of having public accountability.
Okay, let's go to the broader picture now of judicial discipline.
If the system they operate in doesn't require accountability, transparency, and fairness, transgressions are going to occur.
All right, that's Maida Malone, president and CEO of Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts. That nonpartisan organization issued some recommendations regarding judicial discipline. And you alluded to it a little bit earlier, David. I'd like to get both of your thoughts. That came after these three high-profile cases involving Pennsylvania State Supreme Court justices.
Yeah, and I think we understand why there's a call for more openness and more accountability at this point. I mean, those three office holders falling from the Supreme Court, I mean, that's a major blow to the confidence that citizens we'd like them to have in the judicial system. And when you see that kind of misconduct resulting in people losing their offices, or if you see even smaller judicial offices regarded as kind of political offices only, this tends to put the judicial branch into public disrepute. And I think for that reason alone, we need to think hard about how judges are disciplined and how we run the whole system.
I think there's an institutional helplessness that people feel when they, because if they look at a judge, the judge is, you know, the job instantly comes with respect. People see that and they think,
that's right,
you know, this is the person who's going to, one way or another, well, I may win, I may lose, but this person's going to fairly hear me. So I've done many stories over the years where people did not get a fair shake in court, they felt, and it was, you know, they had nowhere to turn in their mind. And it's really frustrating for a lot of people.
Absolutely. You know, a judge is held in the highest esteem. We put them on a high bench. They wear the robe. I mean, it is an emblem. The judge is the human embodiment of the concept of fairness and justice. And when a person does not feel that they got a fair shake, I mean, people can win or lose in court and not like the outcome. That's not the issue here. A judge can make a mistake on the law and be appealed and be reversed. That's not the issue. When they're not dealt with fairly or they're not treated with respect, that is a major problem, and people aren't automatically going to feel that they have a way to complain about that unless there is an open process that people know about.
Right.
So these recommendations by this organization, the PMC, everything from more openness in the selection of the Judicial Conduct Board, disclosure process to prevent conflicts of interest, and additional powers that will let the board pursue charges against judges even after they've resigned. What are some of the important recommendations that you find from Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts? David?
Well, I think personally the openness and transparency is first. I would like to see more of that in the process. And I really do think we should look at the judicial qualifications for the lower-level judicial offices in Pennsylvania. And Pennsylvania is not alone. We have judicial offices that can be held by non-lawyers. And while you don't necessarily get a good judge when somebody has a law degree, your chances of getting a good judge go way down when somebody has never had legal training. Doesn't mean they're all bad. I don't mean to say that. But let's be real here. We have a system of people setting bails and passing upon minor criminal and civil actions. These things are important to the people in front of the court, and they have a right to a fair shake in front of a fully trained and qualified person.
I want to get some more details on that in our final 2 minutes. We are talking about judges at the district magisterial level.
That's right.
Okay. And I understand there's like more than 30 in Allegheny County that are not lawyers.
That's right.
Yeah.
You're dumbfounded.
Well, yeah. I know of a couple. Yeah. I know them, and they can be wonderful. They can do their job wonderfully. But still, what does it add to have that background in law, though? What does that add to the person who comes before them, David?
Well, like I said, just because you have a law degree doesn't mean you'll be a great judge. But if you don't have one, you're missing a great deal of context about the legal system. Now, these are kind of subjudicial offices in a certain respect. They have very limited jurisdiction, but they make important decisions in people's lives. And I think the idea that you're going to court in front of a judge on a legal matter, people are entitled to know that the person who is going to decide that dispute is fully trained. And we don't necessarily have that, though we may have some very good district judges who do wonderful things. It is important for the confidence that people need to have in the system.
Right.
Yeah, I just did a really quick, I did a quick search and of across the state of people who are running for magistrate's office. I found more police officers, people who worked for a magistrate, president of a Crime Stoppers group, state constables, which is another Pennsylvania archaic position, auditor, city auditor, real estate broker. I mean, these are people, I'm sure they're great at what they do, but there should be a qualification there. And take, for example.
All right, they do have to get certification.
They do.
Yes.
In fact, a judge was prevented from taking office this year when he failed his test initially after taking his class, and he has since passed. But take, for example, former city councilman Gene Riccardi. I think that Gene Riccardi comes from the right place. I think he comes from that background of doing the right things for constituents. But when he handles landlord cases, he's putting these hundreds of thousands of dollars of fines on these property owners, these bonds. And it's just I don't know that's law that it's great. It's a great symbol. But how enforceable is something like that? It's just. Yeah.
David, you get the final word.
I just fear for the fact that we look at these judicial offices as political, and that's to be avoided at all costs. So if we could avoid that, if our system did not make these political offices, but at least judicially qualified law degree offices, that would help.
All right. David Harris is a professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, and he is host of the very popular podcast, Criminal Injustice. Charlie Deitch is editor of Pittsburgh City Paper. Gentlemen, thanks so much to both of you.
Good to be with you, Kevin.
Next, an update on the tragedy of a Penn State fraternity pledge and an effort to eliminate the smoking ban exemptions. That's when the confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, Kennywood Park opens the Steel Phantom in 1991. then the fastest roller coaster with the longest drop in the world. The ride held the record for about 5 years. Now called Phantom's Revenge, it is still considered one of the top steel roller coasters in the world. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for May 12, 2017.
It's the confluence where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pennsylvania's indoor smoking law is not yet 10 years old, but there's another attempt in the legislature to make it stricter. Joining us now in studio is Wes Van Teicher, reporter for Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Welcome back to the show, Wes. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
Okay, if you have a question or comment for Wes, tweet us using the hashtag WESAConfluence. All right, Wes. By now, we've all gotten used to going into a restaurant and the host or hostess no longer saying to us smoking or non-smoking. So remind us, how difficult was it to pass the 2000 Clean Indoor Act originally?
It took about 10 years. Senator Greenleaf from Montgomery County introduced it repeatedly, and finally it just got enough traction to pass with a bunch of these exemptions for casinos, hotels, and bars and restaurants, along with private clubs, all carved out exemptions for themselves.
And so that was done, okay, they carved them out for themselves, or their lobbyists carved them out for the legislators?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, all these groups have a lot of lobbying, and some of them, especially the gaming is probably the biggest one and likely to be the biggest hurdle to passing this proposed exemption that's going through. There's so much tax revenue that comes from these casinos, about $3 billion per year in the state, and that's a big kind of negotiating token for them.
So this is, in a sense, where the state benefits from the casino revenue, and the state could be hurt if business goes down because people can't smoke in the casinos.
Right. That's the argument they're making. But of course, some people say that the business probably wouldn't go down if smoking were not allowed in these casinos. People are going to drink. They're going to gamble. Whether or not they can smoke in these locations is the other argument.
Okay. But they might not sit as long at these locations, so therefore gamble away more money, making more revenues for the casinos and therefore for the state.
That's an argument.
Okay, that's an argument. And that's the argument that casinos likely will make if it ever gets that far.
Likely, yes.
Okay. So, and the bars, I want to get to some of the bar owners that you talked to for your piece that you've done for the Trib. And, but I want to, the 2008 Clean Indoor Air Act. It was for bars exempted that did a certain level of food business. Is that not correct?
Correct. 20% or less of sales coming from food.
Okay. So most of their customers going there to have a drink.
Right.
Okay. So that takes me to your most recent story for the Trib. You talked to, and I would have thought, going in, reading your story, that these bar owners would have said, no, we're against any changes, we're against more restrictions, we're against eliminating the exemptions. But that wasn't across the board, was it?
That wasn't. I was kind of surprised, too, to find some of them saying things like, this is not a level playing field, is one argument that's being made. We shouldn't just exempt some and not all. If we're going to allow it, we should allow it anywhere or nowhere. That was one argument I heard. Another, some bar owners have made changes themselves, voluntarily got rid of the smoking exemption even after allowing it for a couple of years. And one guy I talked to, Gene Ney of Gene's Place in Oakland, said that his sales have even gone up since he did that, primarily because he serves college students and fewer of them smoke these days.
Interesting, because of his clientele and the age of his clientele.
Correct.
All right. Okay, so it's one of the arguments from the bar owner. I read one of the comments was, it's like, you're intruding on my business. I think he said something like, it's my business, stop stepping on me. I mean, that's my words, but he said it's my business.
Yes.
So is that an attitude that we can expect, or did you hear that repeated from other owners?
I did hear that repeated, and even some, not everyone was willing to talk with me on the record, but some bartenders were saying that kind of thing. Some people who were at these bars smoking and drinking were saying that kind of thing. People generally around here especially don't like the idea of the government coming in and telling them what they can and can't do in a private business.
Okay, so let us get to this latest attempt to eliminate the exemptions. State Representative Matthew Baker, I believe from Tioga County.
That's right.
He's a Republican. What's his reason for doing it, and would all the exemptions go out the window under his legislation?
Yeah, the bill, the proposal as written, would amend the 2008 law to just simply wipe out the whole section that has exemptions. That's as it's written right now. He's the House Health Committee chairman, so I think that's why he's doing this. I mean, there are a lot of groups, lobbying groups, like as you said, from American Cancer Society, the American Heart Association, they're all pushing for this. And he is, doing that for those reasons, for health reasons. That they're primarily concerned about workers, they said, secondhand smoke exposure among people who work in these businesses, who they feel have less of a say in their exposure.
So my final question, Wes, is this. There was an attempt, I believe, in 2015 to do this. It failed, or didn't get as much traction as supporters would have wanted. Is there more hope this time around? And maybe you alluded to it by talking about the clientele, that one bar owner, that there's been some cultural changes. So is that what the hope that the supporters are basing it on, changes in our culture?
You know, that's what I've heard. I've asked that question to numerous people, and some people think that the sponsorship of Matt Baker will go farther than the previous attempt, which was introduced by Representative Tom Mert, also from the Philadelphia area. It's cultural shifts. I think the main opposition they're expecting at this point is from the gaming industry. So we'll see what happens there.
Well, Wes, we look forward to your continued reporting on this subject.
Thanks, Kevin.
Wes Van Tyscher is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. It's the confluence where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. 18 members of the Beta Theta Pi fraternity at Penn State face charges in connection with the February 4th death of sophomore Timothy Piazza of Lebanon, New Jersey. Joining us now by phone is reporter Lori Falls from the Center Daily Times. Welcome, Lori.
Hi.
Remind us, Lori, Timothy Piazza was pledging to the fraternity. Briefly, what happened? What led to his death?
What we know at this point is that Timothy had just found out that he was accepted as a pledge. There was a party on Thursday night around, I would have to look at the timeline right now, but it was sometime between 10 and 11. There was a fall. And he didn't get help that night, according to a lot of video evidence. There was concern from different parties who were there that night. There was a lot of alcohol going on, and it was ultimately about 12 hours before anyone called for any kind of help for him.
So they didn't call?
And he died on Saturday in Hershey.
All right. So there was no call to 911 over the course of those many hours, correct?
No.
Okay. Now, 8 of the 18 face the most serious charge, that's aggravated assault, plus that carries a sentence of 10 to 20 years in prison, also charged with...
Actually, the most serious charge is involuntary manslaughter.
Yeah, but, and you would think that that is the most serious, but its actual weight of prison time is actually shorter, which is amazing in its own sense. So... let me go there. Do we have any dates on when there will be hearings, trials, et cetera, yet?
We do not have any firm dates on that at this point, no.
Okay. So, Lori, tell us, update us, was this fraternity house, was this on campus or off campus?
It was on private property. If you look at a map of campus, it's going to look like it's on campus to someone, but the fraternity house was independently owned and is not part of Penn State.
So what authority does the university have in this matter? Aside from the criminal charges that we alluded to, what authority does the university have if it's on private property?
The university does not have a ton of authority, and that has been something that the university leadership has been has expressed a lot of frustration about, because all that they could do was revoke the recognition of the fraternity, which they did initially on a temporary basis. They'd originally given, I believe it was a 3 or a 5 year suspension, but in March they permanently banned Beta Theta Pi from Penn State forever.
Okay, so initially suspension, currently completely banned. Is there, for the national chapter, is there no recourse or not? Or is it
the national chapter also gave them a suspension originally too?
Okay, so you mentioned the authority of Penn State being limited in this case. Is it considering in your reporting? Have you learned? Is it considering? Is it taking any steps that it can do in terms of the whole fraternity sorority system about cracking down, if you would?
There was a problem with a different fraternity, Kappa Delta Rho, in 2015, which attracted a lot of attention when the KDR, a KDR whistleblower had stepped forward and said that there was a secret Facebook page that was detailing some inappropriate behavior, alcohol, hazing. There were allegedly pictures of naked women who may or may not have had things done to them. And after that, there was a task force that was put into place, but there wasn't really anything that had come out of that. The university did take some big steps after Timothy's death. They put a lot of, like, really, they put a big lockdown on parties on campus, on or not on campus, but parties at the fraternities, on alcohol at the fraternity. And when they came forward and did the permanent ban on Beta Theta Pi, they stepped those up. They have cut in half the number of social gatherings that the individual fraternities are allowed to have next year. They have to have certified bartenders to give out all alcohol, all right, to check IDs. There will be no hard liquor. It's only wine and beer. They have made it clear that if you have any violation of these, justice will be swift and immediate, and that has already happened to Sigma Alpha Mu, which violated the rules that were put in place in over Parents Weekend, actually. They had parties they weren't supposed to have. Things were not happening the way they were supposed to happen, and they are now on suspension.
Yeah, 15 seconds left, Laurie. I was going to ask you, you know, you can put in all these steps, but enforcement, it sounds like Penn State is enforcing those steps.
Yeah.
All right, Laurie, we look forward to your continued coverage of this very sad story. Laurie Falls is a reporter for the Center Daily Times. Laurie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that's the Confluence for this week, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Our engineer is Tom Hurley. Production assistance this week from Katie Blackley. The producer of the Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.